Hi, this is David Rutledge here in the Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to the program. And the final in Matt Beard's first-hand account of the philosophy of parenting, where he's landed on the dreaded H word. Does parenting make you happy?
Bleak news for the mums and dads out there. When it comes to what we're looking for in life, happiness is right at the top of the list. If something makes us happy, we don't need any more reason to do it. And if it makes us unhappy, we need pretty good justifications not to run the other way. But how does that work when it comes to raising children? Parenting is, to use a cliche, an emotional roller coaster. We're doubled over in laughter one moment and racked with anxiety the next. At the end of it all, can we say it makes us happy? And is that even the right way to think about parenting? Today on the Philosopher's Zone, two philosopher parents explore the joys and woes of raising kids. Our first guest is Caroline West, a philosopher from the University of Sydney. She's an expert on happiness. She looked at the evidence on parenting and happiness and took the plunge anyway. There are plenty of people who contemplate the decision about whether or not to become a parent with regard to happiness. Is this going to have a net benefit on their happiness, or is it going to have a net cost? And there are plenty of books that have been written on the subject of parenting and happiness. But do you think the happiness question is a make or break one for the way in which people contemplate whether or not to become parents?
I think it is for some people, and probably not for everyone. But as you say, there are a lot of discussions of the adverse impact of having kids on happiness. And part of the reason those studies are so discussed is that they seem to challenge, you know, a very widespread common view that having kids is a source of happiness, a major source of happiness, and that children are just a bundle of joy. But I think actually that we need to think about what these studies are measuring and look very carefully at whether what they're measuring is really happiness or happiness of a kind that most of us care about. One thing that the studies look at is how people feel moment to moment as they go about their life, you know, the extent to which they experience lots of positive emotions like joy and engagement versus the extent to which they're experiencing negative emotions like anger or frustration or worry or things like that. And what those studies find is that when you follow parents, you know, around the day, parenting is on balance unpleasant. What those studies show is that if you're someone who cares a lot about pleasure, it's really important to you, then I think this data should give you pause. But that's not the only thing that the studies measure. Other studies look at marital satisfaction, for instance. Again, those studies are sort of a bit depressing if you're a parent. They find, unsurprisingly, that people with kids somewhat less satisfied with their marriages, fewer opportunities for intimate relations, they get interrupted when they come along, less time to spend unpressured together, that sort of thing. But if you look at meaning and purpose, people with kids score considerably higher on a sense of meaning and purpose than people without kids.
Recently, an economist named Paul Dolan, in a book called Happiness by Design, kind of echoes a couple of the studies that you've suggested there in suggesting that happiness ultimately consists in the experiences of both purpose and pleasure over a period of time. But is there more to happiness than just pleasure and purpose in kind of broadly painted terms? Are there things that we should seek pleasure in and things that we should seek purpose from? Can we apply some normative considerations to some of this?
Yeah, so it's certainly a view that the ancients had, as you know, that Aristotle thought that happiness, or obviously he didn't use the word happiness, he was talking about eudaimonia, and there is an important question about whether that word eudaimonia means the same thing as our word happiness does. But for Aristotle and the ancient Greeks, to live a good life, you had to take pleasure in the right sources. So pleasure was necessary for leading a life which was high in well-being, but it wasn't sufficient. So someone who takes pleasure in the wrong sorts of things, they might believe themselves to be happy, but they're not really happy. It's interesting that Aristotle didn't think that having kids was a source of eudaimonia. He didn't mention that. He was more concerned with the kind of male pursuits of contemplation and so on at the time. You know, the privileged class had these opportunities for leisure and didn't do much parenting. So for Aristotle, the good life consisted in sort of reflection and contemplation and so on, of the sort that some people think are kind of crowded out a bit by having kids.
So that was Aristotle writing in ancient Athens. What might we make of some of his thoughts today?
Well, I think Aristotle had a very kind of narrow, prescriptive view about the sort of life that it's good for people to have. And by people, he didn't mean people in general. He meant the leisurely classes. You know, he didn't mean slaves and women and so on who unfortunately couldn't be eudaimon. Aristotle thought they lack the relevant abilities and opportunities. But so Aristotle's conception of the good life is, you know, a life of contemplation, a broadly philosophical life, and that's the only way that it's good for humans to live. And I think that's a very narrow view of the good life. I think we don't accept that anymore. On reflection, it seems that there's all sorts of activities, some of them not very contemplative, that are worthwhile and socially important, and we think compatible with leading a kind of good and flourishing life. So I think having kids is one of those activities, you know, that's kind of widely socially valued. People think it's a very worthwhile thing to do with your life, even if, you know, it's perhaps not the most pleasant thing you might be doing. And so to the extent that people think it's worthwhile, it doesn't seem like it's an unreasonable, you know, it doesn't seem like if you choose to have your kids, you're making some sort of mistake about how to live well. So I think we don't accept Aristotle's narrow view anymore about there just being one sort of good life for everyone to lead, the life of contemplation. I think we have much more pluralistic conception of the sorts of lives that are good and valuable, and it's a good thing.
Thinking about parenting primarily through that lens of happiness seems to give rise to a risk, which is that if you don't get the expected experience of happiness that you anticipated when you decided to become a parent, then this is going to breed resentment, this is going to breed frustration, and you're eventually going to look at your children as nothing more than a little vampire that sucks away on those last vestiges of happiness that you had. But is that not a risk? Is there not another ethical lens or concept that we might use that might kind of mitigate these issues? Or does our thinking about happiness, if we think about it well, allow us to navigate some of those dilemmas?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think it's very important if you go ahead and have kids not to think of them as instrumental to your happiness. I mean, that should not be, absolutely not your motive in having kids. I mean, it's not good for the kids and it's not good for you. In fact, John Stuart Mill talked at length, among other things, about the paradox of hedonism, how if you consciously aim at happiness, there's something self-defeating about that. You won't achieve it. So Mill's recommendation that I think is a good one is to find projects that you think are important and worthwhile and pursue them for their own sake. And then you'll get, if you're lucky, happiness, good feelings, pleasure, satisfaction as byproducts of that.
I remember very early on when we went for one of the very first scans when my wife was still pregnant with Darwin, and it was the first time we heard his heartbeat. And I spent so long trying to work out whether I was sufficiently moved by that experience that I lost the experience. I seemed to have fallen into Mill's paradox. I focused too much on what was happening at a meta level and I lost the ability to actually experience the joy that might otherwise have been provided to me. But it seems to me that we're forced into that paradox because so much of the commentary from third parties, from society itself, wants to put parenting in the happiness basket, and they want us to think seriously about whether parenting is making us happy. We're asked to take time out for ourselves to ensure that we are happy as parents. It is at the forefront of people's minds, it seems, and that seems like if we take Mill's challenge seriously, that's a real issue.
Yeah. So I think there's a place for thinking about whether things are going in your life the way you want them to go and whether there are changes that you can make that would be better for you or better for others. So I take Mill's point to be not that it's never okay or appropriate to think about happiness in the context of making major life choices. And let's face it, having the decision to have kids is for most of us a really major life decision, along with career choices and, you know, who to have kids with. You know, these are all major life decisions. And I think it's perfectly appropriate to think when you're making those decisions, you know, as part of the deliberative process is, you know, what are the likely consequences of this? How will this make me feel? You know, and I actually think it's a good idea. I took the happiness and parenting studies home to my partner. He's not a philosopher. He thinks I'm slightly crazy. I said to him, you have to look at these studies, like stare them in the face. Do you still want to go ahead? And I think that's important. The studies do give you useful information. Of course, they give you averages, not information that's necessarily directly applicable to you, but it probably is after all. They're averages. So yeah, I think it's important to make informed decisions about whether or not to have kids. But then having made the decision, I think you shouldn't, you know, go on sort of second guessing yourself and thinking, am I happy now? Am I happy now? Am I happy now? You know, as you're changing nappies and, you know, your kids are screaming in the back of the car and throwing food at each other. And I mean, that's not the time to ask yourself, am I happy now? Am I happy now? Am I happy now?
We acknowledge that there's an uncertainty about whether parenting will make us happy. But if we could answer that question with confidence, would that be the only relevant question to ask with regard to parenting? Will it make me happy or not?
No, I think absolutely not. So I think happiness is one of the things that we need to think about, but absolutely not the only thing. People care quite reasonably about things other than just how pleasant their experience is. So if you have a broader conception of happiness where you think it's not just about pleasure, it's about achieving your desires or those of your goals that you think on reflection are worthwhile, you think it's bound up with certain sorts of activities that connect you to a bigger community, you know, so those sorts of things that people talk about when they talk about meaning, that you're contributing to something larger than yourself. If you think all of those things are also parts of happiness, then, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that having kids is not a great source of happiness in this kind of very broad sense.
Carolyn West, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In The Count of Monte Cristo, Alexandre Dumas writes, "Life is a storm, my young friend. You will bask in the sunlight one moment, be shattered on the rocks the next." He wasn't writing about parenting, but he may as well have been. Parents often form a unique, powerful love for their children, one which is equal parts life-affirming and heartbreaking. What should we do with the heartbreak? Fear it? Embrace it? Overcome it? Philosopher Damon Young thinks trying to protect ourselves from the heartbreak in life is cowardly. He thinks we need to dive into life wholeheartedly, even though it means we'll almost certainly be left smashed on the rocks.
My name is Damon Young. I'm a philosopher and author. I'm an associate in philosophy at the University of Melbourne.
Damon, when you first tell people that you're going to become a parent, people give you that sage and somewhat esoteric piece of advice. They tell you your life's about to change in ways you can't understand. And they're right, and usually the reason they're right, it has something to do with the kind of love that you will experience for your child once they become your child. But that love can also be crippling, it can be paralyzing, because once you have that love, there is the possibility that it might leave you.
Yeah, that's right. Someone once described having a child as essentially a hand grenade thrown into a marriage. And I thought that was funny when I first heard it. But what it doesn't touch on is what that hand grenade does to your psyche. And I think having a child is a kind of beautiful trauma. It really does take you apart in many ways. It makes you extremely vulnerable emotionally. And there's a poem by the 18th, early 19th century Japanese poet, Issa. And he was a Buddhist, so he believed in the transience of the world, the illusion of all things. So he wasn't supposed to get too attached. But after his daughter died, he wrote this poem about a month later, and it was, "This dewdrop world is just a dewdrop, and yet." I mean, there's that sense of we want to distance ourselves from it. We want to make things safe. We want to say, no, all things shall pass. And yet, when you have a kid, you are tied to this world and those strings pull at your guts.
In a different part of the world at a different time, the Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius was often kind of reflecting on parenting. And he advised that when you kiss your child goodnight, imagine your child dead in the morning as a way of dealing with that vulnerability and preparing for it. So in response to that kind of that groundedness, that and yet that throws us into the world, on the one hand, you have a Buddhist saying that this is inescapable. And on the other hand, you have a Stoic, and oftentimes those two ideas intersect in ways, saying that, well, we ought to take steps to distance ourselves from that groundedness. But today that would strike people as fairly cold.
Yeah, look, I think not only is it cold, I think it's gutless. You know, I think if your whole life philosophy is essentially about avoiding pain, you're a coward. Now, there's nothing wrong with being wary of harm. We don't want to destroy ourselves. We want to protect ourselves often so we can help others. But this idea that your sort of philosophical ideal is about avoiding discomfort, that's not life. That's a living death. I think the Stoic ideal is dangerous. I think the Stoic techniques are helpful. So I don't want to aim what they aim for, which is apatheia, literally non-feeling. That's not my goal, and I think that's an inhuman goal. What I do think, though, is that the Stoic sense of, I don't want to say mindfulness, but taking care of your own psyche, being aware of what you're thinking and how you're thinking, taking note of what prompts you to feel pleasure or pain, grief or regret, asking at the end of the day, what have I felt and why? I think these things can be quite useful. Why are they useful? Because sometimes there is so much devastation in the world that we're aware of. It can destroy us and mean we can't take care of others. We need to know when the world is going to break us, and we need to know when that's going to stop us being good. So if something is going to undermine my duties to others, then I am going to get stoic about it. I am going to shut these things off and say, I would like to be able to feel these things. I would like to be able to recognize these horrors, but I'm just not strong enough.
This is consistent with the ideas that Martha Nussbaum talks about, especially in her book, The Fragility of Goodness. And she argues that what it means to be a human being is to really invest in the world, even to the extent that it would break you. She kind of thinks that there's something limiting about that stoic distance keeping us unbreakable. But we do have this kind of preoccupation with resilience today, and that extent to which we ought to be unbreakable. We ought to only be dependent, but to the extent that we can free ourselves of those bonds and maintain some sense of well-being. Parenting really challenges that, because it seems inevitable that in some ways you will be heartbroken at different points.
Yeah, first of all, I think I should also try to give the Stoics their due, and also Buddhism, a philosophy for which I've got enormous respect. There is an important insight in the idea that many of our responses to the world are conditioned, are contingent, are sort of very much a product of sometimes flawed thoughts or flawed habits or some kind of social conditioning. But where the Stoics certainly, and Plato, who Nussbaum talks about, where they fail is the idea that somehow it is a good ideal to avoid pain altogether. And I think Nussbaum rightly argues that a person who does not respond emotionally to tragedy, whether it's their own or in literature, is somehow morally flawed. And there are all kinds of goods that require fragility. And of course, Nussbaum's example is something like friendship, but also parenthood. I don't think you could possibly enjoy the riches of passion that you could if you were somehow numbed to your child's vulnerability and your vulnerability. I mean, a person who is incapable of feeling the pain is also incapable of feeling the joy.
The first time that I saw my son walk and take steps, he was uncertain as to whether he was going to be able to do it or not. And he looked at me with a kind of uncertainty, and I looked at him with a sort of uncertainty. And then he took his first few steps. And that was delightful. But part of what made it delightful was the possibility that it might not come to pass.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a parent, there is something sort of immensely threatening but also beautiful about being responsible for others. I mean, when I remember my daughter, when she was just a toddler running down the road, and she was just going pell-mell, as they do, like, I can run, I'm king of the world. And then, of course, she's just tripped over a tiny crack in the path, gone smack down on the ground and just busted up her mouth. And, of course, my response as a parent is absolute horror. And yet a little bit later, when the tears are dried and she's just holding me for support, it's one of the most perfect moments as a parent. The idea that someone looks to you to give them comfort, consolation, love, the sense that somehow you were like an existential anchor to them. And later on, they'll pull up anchor and sail away and leave you to deal with that sense of incompleteness. But for that moment, the idea that you can give someone some kind of existential ground, it's a beautiful thing.
This morning, I was awake from about 3 until 5 a.m. because Darwin wouldn't get back to sleep. And I face this challenge every time this happens, wherein I have this beautiful, beautiful human being ideally falling asleep in my arms, but if not, looking up at me and trying to have a chat. And part of me, for pure survival reasons, needs to detach from that. I need to disconnect. I need to just be, as it were, a zombie for the purposes of rocking him back to sleep. And at times I feel great guilt at that. Well, I should be present. I should be engaged in this moment. I should be authentically and in full faith committed to this process of putting my son to sleep. But that also seems like an unfair expectation in a time where maybe stoic detachment is a virtue in some way.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, children are wonderful vampires. I mean, you say you need to be a zombie. Children are vampires. They feed off you. It's exhausting, draining, and sometimes quite lonely. Of course, it can also be beautiful and intimate, but these things depend so much on individual circumstances.
And,
but
of course, it can also be both of those things at the same time.
At the same time.
Which is the point of vulnerability.
Yes. I mean, this is a huge theme that runs through parenthood is ambivalence, is ambiguity. These same gorgeous creatures that fill our lives with joy also tear us to pieces. And, yeah, I think sometimes we need to give ourselves a break and just say, look, as you say, I would love to be just fully in the moment here and just feeling the being of the second. But basically, I've had 3 hours sleep and physiologically I'm about to break down. So I have to take care of myself so I can take care of others.
It's interesting you bring up breastfeeding as an example, because vulnerability has been kind of discussed as a trait or a characteristic that is particularly difficult for men to access, whereas stoicism is a disposition that has been more typically associated with masculinity. But if parenting is about vulnerability, if it is about this balance between times of detachment, but then times of being all in, times of experiencing that and yet that you described, Does that paint a difficult picture for fathers in experiencing the fullness of parenting?
Look, it shouldn't, but it does. And I think that's partly because we buy in, we invest bodily, emotionally into these tropes about what it is to be a man. Oftentimes the most morally good but also beautiful thing you can do as a parent is draw on your vulnerability to help others. Use your experience of pain and regret and grief to be there for the people who need you, so you understand what it is to be fragile. You understand what it is for the world to be precarious and prickly. If you are someone who diminishes feeling and downplays our sort of essential brokenness, my hunch is you will be less able to help others. There are no good reasons why men can't do this too. I mean, they do. We know they do it. It's just that it doesn't fit with this absolutely bollocks notion of masculinity that we have.
Damon Young, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I started this personal investigation to try to see what philosophy had to offer parents, given so few philosophers in history have wrestled with the subject. It turns out philosophers have been doing parents an injustice. There's huge benefit to applying the tools of the trade to the questions of raising children. Moreover, philosophers have let themselves down. By ignoring family life, they've missed out. It's a fertile ground for learning and reflection. Plato believed philosophy begins in a sense of wonder. Aristotle agreed. So, the next time you find yourself struck by the awesomeness of a child learning to walk, the gut-wrenching anxiety when your teenager comes home late, or the chest-swelling pride when your little ones have finally grown up, take a second. A philosophical question is just around the corner.
Matthew Beard, ethicist, philosopher and new dad, completing his four-part series there on a neglected area of philosophy, parents, children and families. And you can read a very engaging overview online. It was written by Matt, two articles in fact, links on the website. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and executive producer Joe Gelonesi. I'm David Rutledge and you've been in The Philosopher's Zone. See you next time.